The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free Arfcom do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the stick of battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free Arfcom starts now.
Good evening, fellow ARFCOM members, and anyone else out there listening. My name is Benjamin, and it's now time for your Radio Free ARFCOM, the Internet's voice for AR15.com, broadcasting live from South Florida. This is your show, so feel free to call us at the new number, which I have posted in the forum, 415-287-0074, and please visit the Radio Free ARFCOM forum on AR15.com. You can also go to the show topics thread for tonight's show and get the additional call-in numbers. I'd love for you to share your thoughts and comments with us here at Radio Free ARFCOM, and please visit AR15.com's site sponsor links and support Radio Free ARFCOM and AR15.com by purchasing a team membership in the AR15.com store. Also, don't forget about AR15.com's Special Operations Support Raffle. Tickets are only $10 and directly benefit our frontline special operators. Click the tab found at the top of your ARFCOM site announcement page. We have a packed show tonight, full of information and ARFCOM-worthy entertainment, so let's get started. As always, I encourage the listening audience to submit show topics, ideas, and potential guests as soon as possible so I can book them ahead of time. For you regulars, please encourage your ARFCOM friends, as well as other friends and family, to listen to Radio Free ARFCOM. The more listeners we have, the more support we get, and can continue to make this show better and better for you, the audience. If you have any ideas for the show, please don't hesitate to let me know. And remember, I work for you, the audience. And those of you on AR15.com can contact me via email at benjamin@AR15.com or simply send me an instant message to me, Benjamin. Moving on. On tonight's show, we're going to recap last week's show, as we always do. We'll look at listener comments from that show. We'll go to the news briefs. We'll have an armed citizen column. Guests will be Joe from the NRA, Colin, who is yet another military veteran who volunteered to come on, and Brian from AIM Surplus to talk about some industry stuff. It'll be a good show, folks. I'm really looking forward to it. Last week, we had Joe DeBergelis on to talk about Trigger the Vote. We also had specialist Lars Reichenbach, an Iraq war vet, who came on and shared some of his experiences working for the National Guard as a convoy man. If you go on the tab, those of you that are online will see that the system message that Radio Free ARFCOM is on the air now. And go into the last week's show thread. We do have a bunch of links up there for you to click. Please visit all those great websites and organizations and visit all those, and please support the sponsors and everything else. And we got a couple guests here commenting from last week. One gentleman by the name, a screen name of Gone Shootin'. He says, I get to listen live this week with a smile. And Gone Shootin', we sure do appreciate you listening in, as well as everybody else who's listening in. We certainly do appreciate all the audience participation. And don't forget, guys, when you're listening out there, I have posted the new call-in numbers for BBS Radio, who we're broadcasting through. Go ahead and call me up if you want something to say or you got something to talk about or you think I'm missing something. But thanks again, and we have another gentleman here. Some people joining the show for the first time on last week's, and so we certainly appreciate that. All the listeners out there, we do want to, again, encourage you to come online and visit and post and be a participant in the show. On this week's thread, we got some cool stuff. We've got Joe DeBurglis from the NRA. Like I said, we got Brian from AIM. And we got a ton of cool stuff. But also, in the forum, I recently posted a poll on the Radio Free ARFCOM forum, which is tacked at the top of the forum page. And to all you listeners out there, take a minute and please vote in the poll. And try to get some of your other ARFCOM buddies, send them some instant messages, and try to get them to vote, because we're trying to get some statistics on the listening audience and their listening habits for Radio Free ARFCOM, and it would be a big help to me, and I really appreciate your support. The poll is, how many of you listen, or how do you listen to Radio Free ARFCOM? And you can click on, I have a couple of different options. I regularly listen to the online show. I sometimes listen live to the show, and so on and so forth. So please, I'd really appreciate it if you guys go ahead and hit that poll and let me know what some of our, I guess you could call them, the demographics are on our listenership. But I do want to know some of that info. So if you could please get as many people to hit that and answer honestly, I'd really appreciate it. On upcoming shows in the next couple weeks, I'll have some really great guests on for all you Radio Free ARFCOM fans. We're going to continue the military interview segment of veterans of the current wars. Also, if you are a veteran and would like to come on and talk about some of your experiences in the military, regardless of if you were in a war or not, drop me a line and come be a guest on Radio Free ARFCOM. All it takes is a phone call. Also, for you readers out there, I've got a special guest coming on in the next week or two. It is ARFCOM member Stephen Pajak and author of Mad Swine, a new zombie novel about to go to print. We'll be interviewing him as soon as I get done reading the manuscript, so everybody can look forward to that. I'd also be interested in talking to anyone on ARFCOM or anyone you know who attended the Restoring Honor Rally in D.C. this past weekend. There's been some nice threads on GD with some photos, and I have yet to contact that individual who was there. But if you haven't seen any of it or didn't get to go, I would recommend going on YouTube and watching some of the clips of the Restoring Honor Rally hosted by Glenn Beck with special guests like Sarah Palin and Marcus Luttrell. Are some of the more well-known headliners. In particular, the segment with Sarah Palin talking with the veterans on stage was particularly moving. I have to admit that I found that my office got awful dusty during that clip when those veterans came on stage, and knowing what Mr. Luttrell went through with losing his SEAL team and the gentleman who lost both arms, and then the other gentleman who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for 5.5 years. It was certainly a very, very moving segment, but I would certainly encourage everybody, if you can, if you'd like to watch that and get an idea of what Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor was all about, whether you like him or not, It was certainly a very patriotic and moving scene of tons of support and thousands of people all supporting our veterans and our military, and it was just a beautiful thing to see. And again, Radio Free ARFCOM, and I'm sure that I speak for the members and the staff at AR15.com in saying that we love and support and honor and encourage all of our veterans out there who are listening, whether you're listening, whether you're on active duty, whether you're retired, whether you served 40 years ago or 4 days ago. We certainly honor you, and we'd love to have any veterans on during the show, and we certainly want to make sure that we give them the maximum amount of honor and respect that we can. On a lighter note, football season is here, and in particular, fantasy football. I joined some fellow ARFCOM members, get this, in the Beans versus No Beans Fantasy Football League. One of the inside jokes I'm sure you recognize from your days spending on ARFCOM GD with the Beans and No Beans debate. But at any rate, I did join the Beans versus No Beans League in fantasy football, and since I did, there's all the more reason to talk about it here on Radio Free ARFCOM. Unlike many fantasy football players, I always draft a good quarterback first, and I've done very well in the past using that strategy. In fact, I've been deep in the playoffs and to 2 Super Bowls in all my fantasy leagues in the last 4 years. And this year was no exception draft-wise, and I got my first pick, which was Peyton Manning of the Indianapolis Colts for my starting quarterback. I picked him the last year, and I believe I had him the year before, too, if I can remember correctly. And if you're into fantasy football, you know that consistency is key, and Peyton Manning is certainly consistent. So hate on him all you want, but we'll see. He's certainly gotten me deep in the playoffs. But if you or your other fantasy players want to get on the show and talk some smack about your league, our league, my picks, or fantasy football in general, give me a call here on the show or drop me a line through AR15.com. Excuse me. Moving on to the news, we have the coming from the Gun News Daily website. The war against ammunition, the constitutional rights lost. There's all kinds of stuff going on in the news right now if you're looking and willing to find it. Guest column in the opinion section, have law-abiding citizens lost their constitutional rights? It says, in all likelihood, a successful usurpation of our constitutional rights continues to be thwarted by the word inalienable. Its definition resembles a traffic light stuck on red to those who would whimsically revise our blessings at birth. He goes on to say, this author, Jim Bowman, Thomas Jefferson said it best in our Declaration of Independence when laying the foundation to our freedom with the words, quote, endowed by their creator, capital C, unquote, with certain inalienable rights. This distinction that our individual rights, of which our Second Amendment is certainly one, are rights inherited at birth from our Creator. As such, they are above the corruptive machinery which is so characteristic of a big government, or as Jefferson termed, the mischief of man. If you want to read more on that, it is on the Daily Times of Delaware County, Pennsylvania. One of the big issues, in particular on ARFCOM or AR15.com, whatever you want to call it, as well as the NRA, is the EPA petition calling for the lead ammunition ban, a huge issue for everybody out there. Now we have a new release through the EPA website. This is on yosemite.epa.gov, but I'll go ahead and give you a little bit of background on that. The EPA was, I guess, solicited by an environmental group that ostensibly wanted to ban all lead ammo, regardless of what the use was for in their whatever quest for. The mention was making ammunition and making hunting and all this waterfowl land and whatever safe. But most of us who have been following these subjects have seen through a lot of that and basically know that it was potentially a backdoor gun ban through default by ammunition. But going through the news release from the EPA, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency today denied a petition calling for a ban on the production and distribution of lead hunting ammunition. EPA sent a letter to the petitioners explaining the rejection. There is a link for the letter. Steve Owens, EPA Assistant Administrator for the Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention, issued the following statement. Quote, EPA today denied a petition submitted by several outside groups for the agency to implement a ban on the production and distribution of lead hunting ammunition. EPA reached this decision because the agency does not have the legal authority to regulate this type of product under the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, nor is the agency seeking such authority. End quote. They go on to discuss the intricacies of that action, but suffice it to say that it's good for all of us that the EPA did not certainly get what they were asking for from these, well, of course they weren't asking for it, but the petitioners were, and that would have been potentially bad for many gun owners. If you look on the Investors Business Daily website, theinvestors.com, one of their editorials, the EPA's gun control, it says, regulation, the U.S. Supreme Court says Americans have an individual right to keep and bear arms. The EPA says that the bullets for those guns may be banned as an environmental hazard. The endless power grabs by the federal Leviathan know no boundaries of law, science, or even common sense. The EPA of Lisa Jackson is seriously considering a petition by the Center for Biological Diversity, a leading anti-hunting group, to ban all traditional lead ammo under the TSCA of 1976. If the EPA approves the petition, the result will be a ban on all ammunition containing lead core components. Bullets made of other materials than lead are often considered armor-piercing by law and are banned, so this amounts to gun control by stealth. Where permitted, it increases the cost of gun ownership and use. Again, folks, that was just a little blurb out of the Investors Business Daily editorials, but the big issue was that, thank God, I don't know how many people sent emails or letters. I know I wrote a letter to Lisa Jackson at the EPA as soon as I heard about this. There was dupes ad nauseum on AR15.com about this very issue and subject material posted over and over again. I know the dupe police are always out there, in particular in GD on AR15.com, but I think that this is one of the cases where we may be let's not break each other's balls as far as putting the dupe police out there for a big issue like this, because this is one of the huge issues that we faced. I don't know how many other thousands and potentially millions of people sent emails. I know I sent one, and I thank everyone out there who's listening or who encouraged or wrote a letter or an email or sent a message to the EPA, but this is one of those things that through our collaboration with the NRA, responsible gun owners, we got to fight this stuff head on, because if we don't send the message, if we don't take 5 minutes to write that email or to write a letter to that congressman, they're going to be the ones that through bureaucracy and regulation are potentially going to take away all of our rights to firearms, and in particular, hey guys, all our ammo does us no good in the world if we can't purchase, if our guns do us no good in the world if we can't purchase ammunition for them through some type of, as they say, backdoor registration or banning of, they say lead ammunition, but what they really mean is all common ammunition that's affordable to the vast majority of the hunting and shooting community. Moving on now, folks, to the armed citizen. And I just want to say I do thank you all for listening. It's great to be on the air, and it's great to have all these listeners and to be on AR15.com and to work with the NRA, ILA.org, which is where we find the armed citizen column, as we do each and every week. Armed citizen Roy Harris, his wife and two children were awakened around 4:25 a.m. when two criminals broke into their Alexandria, Louisiana home. As Harris's wife and children hid, he retrieved a gun and fired at the two intruders, killing one and wounding the other. The wounded intruder was taken to a local hospital and faces murder charges for the death of his accomplice. Police have no plans to charge Harris. Home invaders would be wise to avoid Alexandria, Louisiana. Across town, another homeowner defended himself with a gun and wounded an intruder the same night Harris did. And that comes to us via the NRA ILA through the town talk of Alexandria, Louisiana. Always good to hear that a responsible, law-abiding citizen using his God-given, constitutionally protected rights was able to protect him and his family. But remember, folks, being armed is actually a lot closer to the last step in personal protection and preparation. Give me one second here, folks. Just look at housing demographics, particularly as a percentage of population. Most people live on or near the coast, basically within 100 to 150 miles of the coast. That's where most of us live. The reason I bring that up is that there are currently three storms swirling out in the Atlantic. So, statistically, a huge percentage of the American populace is at risk of being caught in a potential natural disaster like a hurricane and its aftermath. So, I want to encourage you ARFCOM members and Radio Free ARFCOM listeners out there to get and be prepared. You don't even have to live on or near an area vulnerable to hurricanes. It's up to everyone to be prepared and to prepare their families regardless of where you live. Natural or man-made disasters can and do occur at any given time. Therefore, now is the time to prepare. It only takes a couple of extra dollars when you go to the grocery or hardware store. For example, while purchasing the usual groceries at Walmart today, I saw they had the instant ramen noodles on sale for a quarter apiece. I picked up two cases of instant lunches, cheap, long-lasting food that can be invaluable in an emergency situation. For a little less than $6, I've got enough to feed two people for 2 weeks in an emergency. It's just little steps like that that can make the difference in being prepared for survival or giving in to failure in an emergency. Granted, everybody has different needs, and being in Florida at the peak of hurricane season, my needs are potentially different from yours. However, basic survival preparations can be incorporated into your daily, weekly, and monthly routines at only a small additional cost of time and money. Just buying, for example, an extra case of bottled water doubling up on cans of soup, or buying some extra batteries and a flashlight next time you're at the hardware store can make a huge difference in a survival situation. Just a few simple preparations can and will put you ahead of 95% of the population that's used to having everything available 24 hours a day at the grocery store or Walmart. Do you and your family a favor and start by being prepared with food, water, and shelter for those who will be relying upon you. After that, go ahead and stockpile those mags and ammo. Just remember, you can't eat bullets. And on that note, neither can the family dog, cat, or parakeet. Please don't forget about Fido. Make sure you prepare for your family pets as well with a little bit of extra pet food. The bottom line is being prepared to defend you and your loved ones is a responsibility no one else can or will do for your family. In the spirit of rugged American individualism that the United States was founded upon, you absolutely cannot and should not rely on anyone other than yourself and God, particularly not government, to provide for you and protect your family. However, there is one group out there that's always out there preserving and protecting your God-given, constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms for self-protection. That organization is, of course, the NRA. And with us on behalf of the NRA is our regular guest, Mr. Joe DeBurgulis. Welcome to the show, Joe. How you doing, sir?
Doing well, Ben. Doing well. Very sage and sound advice as usual.
That's great to hear from you, Joe. And what's your take on not only, I guess, kind of from the little monologue there, but obviously one of the main things we like to talk about is obviously we're all fans of firearms, but many of our enthusiasm for that comes from a more base need of the ability and the will to protect our family, and the NRA's out there protecting our rights to be able to do that sort of thing.
Well, most certainly. I mean, I think your words, as I mentioned, were sage and very wise in protecting and storing for a potential future, protecting your family's rights on a variety of fronts, not only just firearms, but for survival. Some of the tips you gave are very good. I mean, the federal government suggests that you have at least 3 days worth of sustenance, 3 days worth of money, funds, and what have you to keep you going. I recommend in some of the classes I do at least 2 weeks, depending on where you live. If you have weather concerns, up here in the Northeast, we usually have a blizzard or two or heavy snowfall. So we always make sure that we have X number of dry products in the house and that kind of thing to ensure that you can sustain yourself. Probably the best example of that is Katrina. And when you see people who didn't take any type of protective measures, unfortunately, they're subject to looking for somebody to help them out. Now, that's obviously a glowing example. But if you look down at various other communities that prepared themselves for it, Florida being one of them, who's constantly under hurricane threat, took corrective measures. Haley Barber, can't say enough about what people in Mississippi did. Fantastic. These are things, if you're forewarned, you're forearmed, and just take a few steps to protect yourself and family. One thing I would add, a lot of people seem to neglect, is that you get at least a month's supply of your medications you need. That's another thing to have on store. Just in case something does happen, you can't access that. Just if you have grandparents, if Fido, as you mentioned, is on any type of medication, get enough for him or her. So these are little things that you should have and make sure that you have at the ready in the unlikely event that you may need them. Because when you do need them, they're right at your fingertips.
Well, that's great, and that's excellent advice on top of what we were talking about in the monologue. Going back just one segment there, we were talking about, and I'd emailed you, I'm not sure if you got it in time, but we were talking about the potential that, thank God, it's been rescinded, but the potential EPA is looking at, or was looking at, potentially banning lead ammunition. And what I see from these sorts of efforts is that an anti-hunting group, or ostensibly an environmental type of group, but really they don't like hunting, they don't like shooting and killing game. I would ask them personally, where do you think meat comes from? But that's beside the point. But I think that this is one of what I call a probe, where they throw this stuff out there. It's like throwing it at the wall and seeing what sticks. And then now the idea is already out in the general public's mind, or at least the firearm community's mind, that, oh, well, gee, they were considering a lead ammunition ban. And I think that one of the scariest things is that, and not that this was produced, and I don't necessarily even think that this lead ammo ban that they – I don't think they intended for it to even – they would have liked to have it go through, but I don't think they really intended that. I think that they were kind of just putting it out there, because once you put something out in the public's mind, I think that when new pushes for that same type of – whether it be legislation, regulation, I think once you begin to open people's minds up to it, it becomes much easier for them – to push through in the future. They may have known that their first effort wouldn't have succeeded, but once it's out there, I think those types of things can potentially, and unfortunately for us, gain steam. What's your take on that whole situation, Joe? I know you're very familiar with all the things that are going on with the NRA and the firearms community.
Well, certainly we put them on point. Chris Cox wrote a very poignant letter to the administrator of the EPA, because frankly, EPA doesn't have any type of regulatory authority to regulate ammunition of any composition. This basically doesn't fall under their purview. And they tried to, it was deliberate on the part of EPA. It was something that was calculated on the part of EPA, and I would broaden it open to the Obama administration to see if this is something they can get, a toe hold or a finger grasp on, and see how far it can go. Rightfully, we identified what the problem was. We fired off the correct letter. We started to make the rounds in Congress and make site visits to EPA themselves. And as soon as we got involved and pointed out the certainty that it wasn't under the purview, they backed away. And this is something where we're constantly monitoring all the governmental regulatory agencies out there to make sure that not only the hunters, I mean, because it also would affect the people who fish out there with lead sinkers and the like. It's something where we're constantly monitoring these things to ensure that at any given injunction, we're going to be there. So we just called them on it, and they had nowhere to go because they don't have any regulatory oversight in that particular matter. So they backed away pretty quickly as soon as we obviously pointed out the rules and regulations of their own agency and organization. So we were very successful in that. And I must also say all the members who took heed to the action alert, who called their elected officials, who called the EPA, who wrote letters, emails, it all made a difference. And that's something we need to do. And, again, it's the importance of grassroots advocacy. If you see something you don't like, you can change it. It takes about 5 minutes to become involved.
Now, what's your take on that as just getting into a little bit deeper? Do you think that this effort was just a probe? I mean, and I'll just say for an example here, where I work, okay, as my day job, I mean, I've said to the audience before, I manage a small gun store. We're not in a great part of town. And what we have is we have people that we think are probing us. You know, people come in and they may not, you know, they may fit a profile of somebody who you may or may not think that could potentially be coming back to rob you at some point in the day. But I think of those people is they're not going to do anything right then, but what they're doing is they're probing you because they want to see what your strengths and weaknesses are. And I think that it's a very similar condition to what this environmental group was trying to do with the EPA. I think they're trying to probe people to see what the strength is and if and how they can get to people because it's all incremental. You know, one of the things that everybody always talked about on AR15.com and at the gun shows and gun owners in general, I say, well, they're going to go for the black rifles first, and then they're going to chip away, and then the hunters are going to say, oh, they're not going to take my double barrel or not going to take my bolt-action hunting rifle or this and that. But here you have the shoe just got put on the other foot. They were going after, quote, hunting ammunition. So tell me what your thoughts are on that. It's just there's a lot to this. It's a very thick pie to cut through, Joe.
Well, most certainly. But we always in the NRA, and as I mentioned, from black powder to black rifles, we sit there and we advocate on behalf of everyone. I mean, if you look at through some of the threads, you see people who slam hunters and call them FUDs, and you see people who say a variety of derogatory comments about people who perhaps never experienced the joy, if you will, of shooting a black rifle or any of its variants. But it's we're all in this together. I mean, you hit it on the head when they said, well, now they came after the hunting rifles or the shotguns or the shot or whatever it's going to be. We have to be very vigilant against any intrusion on any sort of firearm. We're all in this together. If you don't like a particular weapons platform, if you don't like the muskets, then don't shoot them. That's fine. If you like to shoot black rifles, that's great. If you are a pistolero and you want to shoot pistols or handguns, that's great too. But if they come for mine, they're going to come for yours. That's what they do. That's why every time you see a piece of legislation that is trying to modify a tag that goes into black powder, or it's something where they want to ban 50 caliber, or they want to say, no, this gun is bad because it looks evil. We all need to get together. Not to sit back on our laurels and say, well, guess what? They're not saying anything about my particular firearm, so why should I do anything? That's just wrong, because if they come for mine, they're going to come for yours, and that's exactly what they do. These, in particular, this particular EPA situation, they just sat out there and said, okay, let's see how far we can push the envelope. We caught them. We put them on point and said, listen, guess what? You don't have the regulatory oversight to do this. They had to go back to their cubicles, and I'm sure we'll hear from them again. But this has been something, if you trace it back, you'll see they're trying to outlaw lead shot throughout the country. They're trying to say that shooting ranges should be outlawed because there's too much lead going into the ground. Where does lead come from? The ground. So it's something where they're always trying to do some sort of affront to our rights by a variety of pieces of legislation out there, from serialization to micro-stamping to everything else I mentioned. That's why the NRA is where we are. All the great people at the Institute of Legislative Action on a daily basis scour every single piece of proposed legislation, everything that the regulatory, or in this case, perceived regulatory agency does, that may be an affront. So I think you got the tiger by the tail there, Ben, but it's something where we've been doing this for, you know, quite a long time now.
Well, one of the things that struck me when you were saying all this, and it made me think of some of the bigger picture, is that one of the threads I saw on AR15.com today when I was just going through it on the general discussion was, holy cow, I'm in California, now I have to register my ammo? And this is just seems like one of those things. I mean, first you had in California, you had the thing with the condors eating the lead shot and apparently getting sick, however they proved that, and then they decided that wasn't right, but they didn't ever repeal the legislation. And then now you have the whole thing, well, and there's no lead ammo, and you can't use it in California. And then now you have the ammo fingerprint you have to get done, and then you got the handgun registration, long gun registration. I think that, you know, everybody loves to hate on California. You know, I have relatives there. It doesn't seem like that bad of a place, but they're certainly misguided in their treatment and their use and their registration and their banning of firearms, hunting, and ammunition. I think that one of the things we need to be vigilant of, and of course the NRA is certainly the most vigilant, but all of us as individuals need to be vigilant of the potential for something in the draconian laws of California overtaken by a liberal elite to become mainstream throughout the rest of society in America.
Well, certainly, Ben. If you look at some of the times when I address audiences, I always say it takes about 3.2 nanoseconds when California legislative body proposed some type of anti-gun legislation as it travels the country and it's proposed here in New York, or vice versa. And then once it's passed in either body, they try to spread it throughout the country. So there's a lot of restrictive legislative initiatives out there. I must say out in California, the NRA membership councils do a fantastic job. The state affiliate, California Rifle and Pistol Association, on the forefront of the effort out there. A lot of great advocates, if you will, grassroots advocates out there from a variety of organizations, are really trying to take a step. But unfortunately, California, which is absolutely beautiful and breathtaking, has elected their, I mean, this all goes down to elected officials. And if we look at it, we had a Republican governor, we still do out that way, who's got a lot of liberal leanings. He's a Republican in name only, but he's up against a term limit. You look at their senators, they're obviously liberal lions. So the people of California have the power of the ballot. They have to change and swap out. I think it's going to be interesting in November to see how everything, I know, Boxer's in the fight. So I think it's going to be something to see where that trends. But we also have to be vigilant. That's why I always try to tell people to look around the country, because it'll be coming to your state soon. We have some very good pro-gun states in this country. We truly do. My brothers and sisters down in the South and in the Midwest and are doing great things. But if you look at their legislative bodies, everything that was introduced in New York and California that may have been successful in these two states has been introduced down there as well. It's been defeated, but it's been introduced. So it's going to come, guys. You may feel secure. If you're a hunter, I don't listen to anybody who's going out there with the AR or the AK. Or if you like the AKs, the heck with the hunters. It all boils down to the same thing. We like firearms. They're coming to try to take them away. You have to make sure. They can't do it constitutionally now. We did a fantastic job by banding together in both Heller and McDonald. We just need to band together again and for these other assaults that are coming and take them out one by one. And the best way to do that, go to RFCOM, read some of the postings, some of the, not the ones that, oh, I was just going to renew, or, you know, this organization fill in the blanks better than the NRA or this, and that. That's fine. Everybody has an opinion. But overall, we all got to get involved. That's why each week when we talk, Ben, we always try to bring people together and say, listen, take the 5 minutes to register the vote. Take the 5 minutes to go out and volunteer for a pro-gun, pro-freedom candidate. Take the 5 minutes to educate yourself. If it's only RFCOM, educate yourself on RFCOM. Listen to Radio Free RFCOM every Monday. We'll be getting some good stuff from you. Hopefully people don't get tired of me preaching. And we'll go forward and try to entertain and enlighten and educate if possible. We can do it. It's going to be very interesting this November. But we have to stand together like we have in Heller and like we have in McDonald. And we have to make sure that we put the right people in. That's the power of the ballot.
Well, Joe, I think one of the things that you touched on, and obviously we talk about this all the time, and this is sort of where I'm going with this, but one of the things that we as what do you want, whatever you want to call us, AR15.com, ARFCOMers, NRA members, whatever you want to say about us, we're all one thing, and that's believers in our God-given but yet constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms. And for those of you who haven't heard the show before or who may not be familiar with the show, but we always want to reiterate that these things that we hold dear in our hearts are not things that are based on the laws of man. They're blessed to us through the sole fact of our being born, of our being given divine life and spirit in our bodies. And just by the nature of us being born, we have the right to defend ourselves and to protect ourselves and to protect our families and our homes from those who would wish to do us evil, whether it be through legislation or through outright criminal acts. And so it's important that all of us remember that is the nature of it, is that we have life on our side, whether you want to call it, you know, regardless of whether you're religious or not, whether you want to call it life or religion or anything else, we have it on our side. We do. And it's incumbent upon us as the last free nation upon this planet to defend these rights with everything we've got, because we're the last stand, folks. The USA, the NRA, the AR15.com membership, we are the last stand, folks. And people like Joe and people like me and all you fellow ARFCOMers out there, it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we defend our rights, given every single possible chance that we have, to make sure that we tell people these are rights that are endowed to us by our Creator, not granted to us by our government. And we need to take those steps, whether it be registering to vote or getting out there to vote or going through the NRA and talking with guys like Joe and saying, hey, you know, let's go out and let's trigger the vote. Let's go to triggerthevote.org and talk about this stuff and tell our friends and family members, because without that, we're the last stand. I mean, in America, the NRA, you and me and AR15.com, we are, Joe, we are the last stand.
Well, we are, you know, and there's a lot of good people out there that believe as we do, and they just need to get off their best intentions sometimes and become active. And that term active can be just making a phone call, going to the district offices of your elected officials, introduce yourself, politely state how you feel. If you want to say that you're a member of the NRA or whatever pro-gun organization you're involved with, that's fine. But these are little things. I mean, the elected officials don't expect you to show up at their doorstep. They really don't. And when they see you, you'll have kind of a shock or a look of disbelief, which is what I get all the time, and say, how are you doing? Let me ask you a couple questions about this and that. Now, the elected official may not be in his or her office, but their legislative director may be, or legislative aide, and they're always ready to talk to you. Nice little step, 5 minutes, how you doing? You make yourself known. And there's a calculation out there. There's an equation. They know how many people who come or physically come to an office. That represents X number of voters. When you write a letter, that's another X factor. When you make a phone call, that's another factor. So it really does count in the overall scheme of things. Don't be discouraged if you have somebody who's vehemently against freedom or against your gun rights. Keep going. You never know. You never know where your allies are. And he or she may change their vote on something crucial that we need them for. Some are just, you know, you're dying the wool on the opposite side of our issue. Okay, but you can still sit there and politely talk to him or her. These are little things, Ben, that if we do it together, they'll make, it's the same amount of effort and time, guys. And here's just a, you know, kind of a commentary on my part. If you want to slam something on the thread, be it GD or anything else, it's exactly the amount of time that you expend slamming something or someone on the threads than it is to contact a listed official. Exactly the same amount. You go to nraila.org and you navigate through the system. They'll sit there and do preformed letters for you. It takes about, I would say, maybe a minute to fire one off. It takes longer to write some threads sometimes or put a post up. So these are things where get together. Always, always, always do it on a polite and professional manner. Always. Because to sit there become agitated, swear, they just sit there and dump it. It's not going to do anything. It's not going to do any good. And then it's going to feed into their perception of how we are. You know this, Ben. How many people believe we're all bubbas or we're rednecks or we're this or we're that? That's what they want. That's what the major media outlets want us to see. I mean, just look at the underrepresentation of what they're announcing for the crowd for the Beck event. I mean, it's ridiculous. But they don't want to sit there and give any credence to what transpired this past weekend in Washington, D.C. So that's what we're up against, guys.
Joe, I think you made a great point. And one of the things that really, we're running low on time. We got a lot of guests tonight. We got a lot of good topics. But one of the things that I just want to make sure that everybody knows, and this may seem very silly and very childish, but I was in my chiropractor's office today, and while I was waiting for him to come treat me, I was looking. He's got a DVD up there, and one of the slideshows that was going on says it takes somewhere like, and forgive me, I don't remember what the exact number was, but it was something like it takes, you know, 70 muscles or whatever, 70 to frown. But it only takes, you know, 15 muscles to smile. And I think that's one of the things that we need to remember when we're posting on ARFCOM or writing letters to our congressman or supporting the NRA. It's very, very easy to smile and to let these people know that, hey, we know that we're on the right side of this thing and we're happy people and we're not threatening and we're not, you know, bad people, and we're not going to be, you know, go doing silly and crazy things. It takes a lot less energy to smile and to laugh and to go about your life with a smile on your face than it does to go through angry and pissed off and well, you know, damn the NRA, they're not doing enough, or my politician isn't doing enough. You know, you attract a lot more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. Joe, I'll give you the last word on that, brother.
Well, Ben, you're absolutely right, as always. It's something where if we can unite, just unite under one banner, pro-gun, pro-freedom, we can do a lot of good things. It just takes time for us to sit there and coordinate ourselves. Now, there's extremes on either side of the issue. If we sit there, take the minimum amount of time and effort it takes in order to register to vote, become active in the process, take that 5 minutes to stop and actually vote. We'll be much better off in November. It really will happen. I promise you this. You just have to take the time. And as you mentioned, Ben, it's the same amount of energy, same amount of breath to say it positively as it does to say it negatively. So we'll get there. And I'm a firm believer.
Joe, you're breaking up, brother. But we do certainly understand what you're saying, and we certainly catch your drift. And I really appreciate having you on Radio Free ARFCOM. As always, you are the guest and the voice of the NRA, and we certainly appreciate that. And we'll look forward to having you on again next week. Thank you again, Joe. It's always a pleasure. And everybody else, please, if you can, take a moment to whether you want to send a message or just send a little prayer out. Thank you, Joe, for your continued effort and continued support of not only AR15.com and Radio Free ARFCOM, but also the NRA and fighting out there on the front lines for our rights. Thanks again, Joe. Moving on, please visit AR15.com's site sponsor links and support Radio Free ARFCOM by purchasing a team membership in the AR15.com store. Also, please don't forget about AR15.com's still ongoing special operations support raffle. Tickets are only $10 and directly benefit our frontline special operators, the guys who need our support the most, these breaching implements, battle axes, whatever you want to call them, are going to not only honor our troops, but also be out there busting heads in the side of the good guys. So please click the tab found at the top of your ARFCOM site announcement page. And as always, I encourage the listening audience to submit show topics, ideas, and potential guests as soon as possible so I can book them ahead of time. Now, moving on, our guest is one of our very own ARFCOM members. And the idea for this next segment came to me not only while I was surfing through the various forum boards on ARFCOM, but I was also thinking to myself, what would the typical ARFCOMer want to hear, and who would make a good guest? With that in mind, I posted in the Deployed and Hall of Heroes forum asking for current military as well as veterans who would like to share some of their experiences with the Radio Free ARFCOM audience. And I'd really like to make this into a regular segment. We had our first segment last week, and we'll have another one coming up. But we are talking with the true heroes of AR15.com and the United States, and those are the men and women who are the names and faces that make up not only the greatest military in the world, but the greatest nation in the world. Specifically, we have on our friend Colin, who goes by the name or the handle Armor Not So Light, who was a mortar man in the Army with the 172nd and did a bunch of interesting stuff. He's got an interesting couple quotes. He's done some training. Colin,
you are
a hero, and we are proud to have you on. We certainly love our military and appreciate all your service, and thank you for your honor and your service, and we really appreciate you being here on AR15.com. Welcome to the show, sir.
What's up, man? How you doing?
I'm doing great, brother. How you doing, sir?
I can't complain. It's a beautiful Monday night out here in New Hampshire, so.
Out in New Hampshire. So I hope you guys are bracing. Remember we talked about in the opening segment, we don't want you guys, no matter where you are, if you're on the East Coast or in the on the coast in general, you know, we got to be prepared for these storms that are coming at us. They're throwing them at us left and right, but, I'm certain that, you're taking preparation for you and your family, and we're glad to have you, back here in the United States.
Oh, yeah, dude. I've actually been back a little bit. I deployed 2005, 2006, to Mosul and Baghdad. So, with the, 172nd, I don't know. It's kind of a little place up in Alaska, Fort Wainwright. I ended up in the best part about being a mortarman isn't actually being a mortarman. It's training lieutenants down in Tradoc. That's absolutely the best part about being a mortar. Most mortars don't get to find out, unfortunately, but that is the best part about it.
Now, just a little background for our listeners here, Colin. We had initiated contact, you know, and this is just for background for our Radio Free ARFCOM audience, and we've been talking about what you've done and where you've been, and you say you work on 60s, 81s, and 120mm mortars, but didn't do that in Iraq, and mostly did that while back in the rear, worked at Tradoc and Fort Benning, and training LTs, that would be lieutenants, I assume, how to drop mortars. I guess.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about your experience. I mean, where do you want to start, brother? I mean, this is something totally new to me. I unfortunately didn't get the chance to serve because of an injury right after September 11th, but I certainly am interested in hearing about your experience and want to sort of go where you want to go.
Well, actually, believe it or not, September 11th, I was sitting in my chemistry class in high school. And I watched it live on TV, you know, watched the Twin Towers fall down. And that kind of like right there, I saw, you know, I was like, hey, you know, this it's one of those things, this isn't going to stand, you know. I'm not going to allow this to happen. So I joined the Army in 2003, which was as soon as 2 weeks after I graduated from high school. I was sitting in Fort Benning, Georgia, at the 30th AG, and finished basic training as 11 Charlie, which is a mortarman, and went to airborne school after that. Graduated out of airborne school, and I was supposed to go to Fort Lewis, actually, and deploy with them, but my orders got changed because they were spinning up the 172nd in Fort Wainwright. And so instead of jumping on a mortar striker in Fort Lewis, Washington, I jumped onto a mortar striker in Fort Wainwright, Alaska, which is a whole different ball game in itself. And I trained up there for a couple of years, and then they sent me off in 2005, August, and I got my first taste of combat in November, actually. That was probably one of the worst battles we went through. And so it wasn't, I mean, we get shot at and stuff like that, like before that, but nothing really, no real stand-up toe-to-toe fighting until November. And from there, we headed on to, the greatest thing about Iraq, and I think anybody who's ever been there is going to tell you it, you get to train back in the rear, but in a combat theater, that's the only place you get to use what you learn. You know, blowing doors and, you know, kicking in doors and, stuff like that, night ops. Yeah, it's all fun and games until you get to Iraq, you know, and it gives it an extra edge, you know. Somebody can take you out and you won't even see them, you know. The only thing that'll happen is, you know, your buddies will be trying to find them. But, it gives them an extra edge, really, you know. But, Iraq was, you know, you spend 8 hours a day in the same exact striker with the same exact guys day after day after day. And I'll tell you something, you learn stuff about them that you never even would have assumed, okay? I had a friend, his name's Hedges, and he actually could spell a word faster backwards than anybody else I know could spell it forward. Just random weird stuff like that. My buddy Merced, he was a junior rodeo guy when he was in high school. And that's what he thought. He thought he wanted to be in the rodeo. And, you go through some experiences that, like, really shape your life towards, getting into it. And, I can't ever say that combat is all bad. You know, you learn a lot about your fellow man. And probably one of the best parts about Iraq was that you got completely immersed in another culture, you know. You end up completely, I didn't speak a word of Arabic when I went to Iraq, and I knew conversational Arabic when I got out, you know. So
Colin, let me ask you something here. Now, you've certainly enlightened me and the rest of the listeners, and you've brought up a lot of topics, and I really want to make sure that everybody gets their fill of you, because you've got a lot to talk about. So if you don't mind, I want to make sure that I just want to ask you about some of the experiences you did. First of all, I mean, I think the two things that are important right here are the training. You say you worked on this stuff and you trained, you know, some lieutenants, and then transition from that into now we're actually in theater with you, because, you know, I certainly, like I told you before, you know, you sound like you're probably, you know, you said, judging by the day you said the year you graduated, probably a couple years younger than myself, and I really want to know what you thought. First of all, during your training experience, and you say you in the email you sent me, you worked on the 60, the 81s, and the 120 millimeters. Tell me about those to start with, and then we'll kind of dig a little bit deeper.
Sure, yeah, no problem. I started out in the company 60 millimeter mortars. That's just basically a grenade that you can throw really, really, really far. You know, it's not too terribly powerful, but they're incredibly mobile. You know, so you can drop the mortar and within, say, 5 or 6 minutes of rucking around, you can have it, you know, direct laying on a target. And generally, you'd want to shoot those at, like, people, direct lay, because otherwise it's not really going to do a whole ton of damage. Then you got 81s, which it's quite a bit bigger than a 60, actually. It is 20 millimeters bigger around, 21 millimeters bigger around, but it's a lot longer, a lot heavier, and again, that's for mostly personnel. And then you got my favorites, the 120 millimeter mortar, which I love that thing. You know, reaching out and touching by, you know, at 7 clicks, and that was with the mortar striker. And the mortar striker can actually stop and fire and keep moving in less than a minute. So, you know, you drop 5 120 millimeter mortars fairly accurately in less than a minute and be gone. You know, it's like, that's one of the mortar's weaknesses, is that you shoot a mortar and they can tell where it came from through counter battery. So, you know, you don't want to be there when they start shooting back. You know, it's incredibly loud. It's not like you see it on a movie. It's ridiculously loud, as a matter of fact. You have to wear double your hearing protection when you're in the striker shooting those things. And those are nothing quite sticks in my memory like when I was in Kuwait and we were test firing the 120s, and they test fired the white phosphorus, the Willie Pete, and we dropped a whole ton of Willie Pete 120, and it was like an ocean of fire dancing on the ground. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. We basically, once we got to Iraq, we packed them away and never drove them again, because our mission was basically patrolling. And that's all I did when I was in Iraq, actually. We put away our mortars, and I was all of a sudden, I was rucking around with my secondary MOS, the 11 Bravo infantry. So,
yeah. So you were trained on the mortars, obviously, and you said that was your first MOS, and then now you started to talk about your second. But let me ask you something from obviously I said before, you know, I'm very curious, but, and I try to be knowledgeable somewhat, but I can't know every specialty of every military man that I have on the program. But tell me a little bit about the kit that you trained with, as far as when you were in training doing mortars. What type of gear, because ARFCOM, you know, your audience that's listening to you right now is obviously
they're gearheads.
Gearheads. So tell us about what your kit was when you're a mortar man versus, you know, start with that, and then now you've got your training, then versus what now you have in theater or as deployed.
Yeah, sure. Basically, when I was in, when I was training with the mortars, all I wore was a flak vest. I didn't really get any kind of high speed equipment when I was, training. I didn't get my high speed equipment until 2005, Rapid Fielding Initiative, the RFI. So I didn't really have anything too special then, or, before that. But, after that, I wore, an interceptor vest, which a lot of people complain about the interceptor vest, but I personally liked it. I liked it a lot. It was comfortable to me. It wasn't altogether too heavy until you strapped on all your stuff, which then it got heavy, very heavy indeed. It had Kevlar inserts with an E-Sappy insert on the hard plate. Then, let's see, I was, for the first 5 or 6 months I was there, I carried a Colt M4, and just with the M68 CCO, the basically an aim point. And after that, my squad leader, or not my squad leader, my team leader, Beard, he ended up getting promoted to sergeant. I mean, we'd come up through the ranks. He just happened to get promoted before I did. And he ended up as a sergeant. So that stuck me as the second most senior man in our team with the SAW. So I messed around with the 249 for about, geez, most of my time there, almost a year at that point. And finally, I actually only had it for about 8 months. And that was, I carried it around with the 100-round nutsack underneath. And then, let's see. After that, I transitioned back to the M4, thank God, because I'll tell you something, man. That saw, after 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day of carrying it around, absolutely terrible. And because I was the heavy weapons guy, when we dismounted the 240 Bravo, the Army's medium machine gun, I had to carry that around. But fortunately, I got to ditch the saw, and I ended up with a 240 Bravo and an M9. In a, by the way, I'm a righty, but my lieutenant, whose pistol I was borrowing, he's a lefty. So it was in a left-hand draw Safari Land hard holster. So it was, you know, and then we'd have assorted. Generally, every guy carries like one or two different specialty grenades, such as smoke, or I carried flashbangs because I was our breaching guy. And I carried two flashbangs and an incendiary, or a thermite, on my back, just in case. We'd often find, like, strange munitions. We'd find random, like, RPG warheads and or RPG rockets, and, you know, we'd find grenades and stuff like that, and you got to dispose of it, or you call EOD and wait 4 hours while EOD spins up to come out and destroy it for you. So we used to just, you know, throw it all in a pit, out in one of the many garbage dumps that's all over Iraq, and we'd throw it in the pit and toss it in an incendiary and wait for it to explode. Save us 4 hours on patrol.
Well, that sounds like a pretty wild experience. Now, tell me about, so you're training, you know, as a mortar guy. You know, you're dropping the things, and they're louder than hell, and then all of a sudden you get there. And now, boom, now you're a patrol guy. This is your secondary MOS. This isn't your main deal. How do you transition from one to the other? And then once you get into theater, what's your first reaction? What's your first experience?
Well, when I first started, they told me that I wouldn't be on the front line. Not that I really had worried about it, or, you know, it wasn't really a big deal to me. I had signed up as infantry, which that's what I thought I was doing. I thought I was going to be patrolling and, you know, kicking indoors. And then they told me, hey, you know, we got to have mortar somewhere, so you're it. And I was kind of bummed out about that. And then they told me that we were going to be putting away our mortars when we got to Iraq. So I was like, oh, are you kidding me? This is better than, like, I could have hoped for, you know? Now I get to patrol and, you know, do night offs, do all the stuff I ever, you know, that I signed up to do. And they, so it wasn't really a big deal. We actually trained, as part of an infantry company, you know, so it wasn't really a huge shock. It wasn't really anything that, that was different about it, except we just didn't have our mortars anymore. And we were, only solely patrolling. We did one actual, mission with our mortars. It was like just one random mission. They said, hey, we need some alum for this night op. And we like wandered out there with our mortar strikers and, you know, hung out, and they said, hey, we want alum, send it. So we sent one alum round downrange. We brought out both of our strikers for this. One alum round downrange. And they hadn't cleared the airspace above us, and we almost shot down a Blackhawk with with our one mortar round of our entire deployment. We almost took down a Blackhawk. So, yeah, that was not quite what they had planned on. But either way, you know, they got their Illume anyway, so.
Now let me ask you something. You were saying that you like you got the 60s and the 81s and the 120s, but the 120s are your favorites. Now tell me something. From your experience, just how badass are those mortars that you're sending downrange?
Are you kidding me? They're incredibly badass. 120 millimeter mortars. I don't know if you'll be able to look up a video on YouTube of the 120s actually, because they don't normally do them direct lay, which is where you can see your target. But they normally do them indirect fire, so like we can't really actually see what we're shooting at. But we used to do when I was at Benning, they do these little exercises where the public can come in and see our firepower. Like they'll break out the third IDs, Bradleys, and our mortars and our 120s, and what we would do is drop like, you know, 10 mortars a piece, 10 120s a piece, and you could actually see them explode, and it was amazing. Like you 20 120 millimeter mortars dropping like within seconds of each other, because I mean you can probably put 10 rounds downrange in about, I don't want to exaggerate, probably about a minute and a half. So they're all 20 are hitting within a minute and a half. So, and mortars are scary because you don't actually hear, there's no whistling sound to a mortar, or I've never heard one. And I was actually on the receiving end when I was in Iraq. There's no real whistling sound. You can't really tell until the first one goes off. When the first one goes off, you're like, oh, this is when the indecision hits, okay? Because you're like, should I move, or am I going to move underneath another mortar? Am I going to drive into a, you know, where they're actually firing at? What do I do? Stand still, move. What do I do? You got to pick something. And, 120 millimeter mortars, definitely. That's the way to go right there. If you can't have artillery, might as well have that. So
they're pretty awesome, about what you described. You said they're loud. What? Just grant me the question here. How loud is it? I mean, compared to I don't know, a day at the shooting range, or you're shooting your AR-15, or going to 4th of July with your wife and kids. I mean, where does the sound and the concussion and the explosion rank with one of these things?
Well,
based on your experience.
I would have to say, to be honest with you, I don't think there's actually anything as loud as a 120 besides an artillery piece, you know? It's, it's really loud. Much louder than a 50. A 50, all you have to do is wear earplugs and you're good. But if you only wore earplugs around the 120s in the striker vehicle, you would probably still go deaf. I don't know anybody who only wore earplugs. We used to wear the Bose headsets for communications and pop our earplugs in underneath them, either that or hold our hands over the top of them. And I lost quite a bit of hearing over that little trick. I got like asymmetric hearing loss in my left ear. And it's pretty impressive. I can't hardly hear anything. So, and that was from not wearing double ear protection and probably only 5 or 6 times. But those 120s you're not allowed to shoot more than, and I can't remember exactly how many it is, but I think it's 50 in a day, because the concussion actually messes with your internal organs. So I think it's 50. But
so you're not, it's not like the, you're watching Saved Private Ryan and, the dudes are just dropping the thing, thump, and that's it. I mean, it's
no,
a real deal.
No, not at all.
It's a real deal.
Close. What's that?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you'd say it's a real deal. Boom. I mean, it's not just a little thump.
Yeah, it's no joke at all. I actually do know a guy who, he was in our striker and he was just holding his hands over his ears, and it was dark out. It was a night op, and I think this was in Kuwait. And basically he was just sitting on one of the jump seats in the back of the striker, and he just wanted to see the mortar go off, which is cool, but he was just holding his hands over his ears, and he took his hands off, and they called out the fire command, So I dropped the 120 millimeter mortar while he had his hands like off of his ears, and he couldn't hear me for, I don't remember what it was. I think it was like 6 or 7 hours or something like that. So that's
just from the mortar going off. That's not from it actually exploding either, which is crazy.
I can't even imagine what it sounds like. I've never been on the receiving end of an 81 or a 120, just 81s.
Well, God bless you for not being on the receiving end. That's why you're here on the program, sir.
yeah, right.
You know, we're thankful for that. But we got about a minute left. I got an email from you here. As for funny stories, I remember a night op we did in Mosul. Tell me about the chicken coop.
Yeah, we did a night infill, and we were supposed to be all stealthy-like, and we got on top of what looked like a really low shed in order to vault over the wall, and we had to look over the wall first because they got the Iraqi security systems, which is just broken glass laying on the concrete, and so I looked up, no Iraqi security system, so I grabbed onto the top bricks, and my buddy Borg and I went down underneath the weight of this chicken coop. Like, we thought it was just a shed. It felt pretty solid, you know? So anyway, I grabbed onto this, the top of the brick wall to try and pull myself over. And somebody had mortared all the bricks on the top, the cinder blocks in place. So I dropped 2 cinder blocks on my head, destroyed my nods, my night vision. And, it was probably the least stealthy, insertion in Iraq history.
I guess we're not going to be calling you for the next update on the proper you know, wall clearing and night vision stuff there, are we?
No, that's not me.
Yeah, not based on that. Well, Colin, I can't thank you enough for your service, and it's been an honor having you on the radio for your ARFCOM. Sir, thank you so much for being on the program, and thank you again. And God bless you for serving our wonderful country and being a member of the greatest nation and the greatest military in the world. Thank you, sir.
You're free to come back, and
you're welcome anytime on the program, and we certainly thank you for being on Radio Free ARFCOM tonight, Colin. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
That was Colin from the 172nd. He was in Iraq a couple of years ago, and that was a really cool interview, and he is a very colorful guy, and it was very good to talk to him. Coming up on the phone, we have, this is actually by user request from our friends on the Radio Free ARFCOM forum. You know, we always encourage everybody to contribute and suggest and mention to me what they're interested in hearing. So with that, we have Brian from AIM Surplus coming on the line here shortly. I'm going to check with my producer, and Brian is actually on with us now. And I would encourage all of you listeners out there at Radio Free ARFCOM and AR15.com to go to www.aimsurplus.com. That's AIMsurplus.com. And I'm going to go ahead and click on the link right here while we're online. And we've got Brian online, and you pull up the website, and here you have aimsurplus.com. That's www.aimsurplus.com. And you have all this beautiful stuff on here, whether it's ammo, mags, firearms. Brian, tell me a little bit about what you do and how this business works and what you're seeing in the surplus world nowadays.
Well, you know, we sell a little bit of everything. We don't just do guns and ammo like some guys. We do accessories. We do some surplus from time to time. But we specialize in the C&R items, the curio and relic, the World War II surplus. That's kind of our bread and butter items. That's what, you know, we got known for. That's kind of what we came into the game with. And we try to cater to that crowd. You know, we also do sell, you know, all your new production ammo and a lot of surplus ammo. But that's kind of what we're known for the Cure and Relic items.
Now, for the listeners that aren't necessarily familiar, and like I said, your request came from a listener, and we certainly do appreciate you, Brian, having us, being able to call you and having you on Radio Free ARFCOM, because this is really all about the listeners. And this is a request that you know, I'm only human. I may have not thought of whoever, but I certainly see that there's a market out there for surplus firearms. I mean, I do run a gun store. I'm the manager there, and I'm in charge of ordering, and we see, you know, firearms from time to time. Now, I guess the question would be, tell me a little bit about what the surplus market is right now and what it's doing and where you and your company sort of fit into that whole marketplace.
Well, the Cure and Relic market, you know, during World War II, there were so many arms and ammunition and, you know, items made that post-war, a lot of countries, especially Russia, put back a lot of arms, you know, captured German K-98s, captured Czechoslovakian VZ-24s, captured Mosin Nagant 9130 rifles, and they put back all these items into storage. Well, once, you know, a Cold War went on for a while and World War III never happened, these items became surplus. So we're seeing World War II items that are hitting the market. And, you know, look at the 9130 rifle, the Mosin Nagant, Russia's rifle. That's an item that we sell for $79.95. So pretty much any gun fan in the country can go out, buy a rifle that is ready to go, you know, used during World War II for $79.95. Low entry price. You can get a guy into either collecting guns or just shooting for such a low price, and they can buy ammunition for, you know, a way cheaper price than new production ammo. So we get a lot of new shooters.
You're right, and it is interesting that you mentioned the 9130 in particular, because I'm sure many of our listeners out there who are firearm enthusiasts have been to various stores and various shops, and they've seen that, you know, specifically, you know, there's big box stores that carry them. There's small stores like American Defense that I work for that carry them, because it's a very great rifle for somebody that wants to, whether or not they want to be a collector. It's a great starting item for a lot of people, particularly young people that we're trying to encourage, particularly through the NRA and various programs. You know, we're trying to encourage young people to get into not only collecting but also shooting. Or I have guys who come into my store and they buy that. They say, "Like, I'm missing the gun," and say, "Yeah, it's, you know, it's $100. You get it with it. You get a box of ammo with it, and you can take it out and shoot hogs with it." So I think that that's a very strong market right now for people that it doesn't matter what you want to do. What a company like you, Brian, are doing is you're giving the means to an audience that wants to go out and learn about firearms and learn about collecting surplus firearms.
And it's a great gateway gun. You know, they buy one Mosin Nagant. And let's say they buy the round receiver. And then it's like, oh, you know, this is a great gun. It's a great purchase. I'm happy with it. Look at the cool accessories. Now I want to get the hexagonal receiver model. Or I want to go out and buy the laminate gun. Then next, they want to buy a German K98 to have the German side of it. And then down the road to M1 Garand. So it's kind of a great gateway gun to get them into gun collecting. So it's a neat gun. You know, a lot of guys own 20. There's a lot of guys who buy, you know, 10 of them because they want each variant and year of production. But there's just so many neat collectible stuff in the CNR game that, and it, you know, the one other great thing about CNR weapons is if an individual goes out and gets a CNR license, Curio and Relic FFL, they can have that gun shipped directly to their house. No need to go through a gun dealer. No need to go to a gun show. You know, an owner of a CNR license can buy that directly from me. I ship it to their house, and it's really nice for those guys who maybe don't have a gun store close to their house or don't like to go to the gun shows or, you know, it's just a neat way to do things.
Now, without getting into specific details regarding, you know, like you say, a Mosin Nagant or a British Enfield or whatever the case may be, tell me a little bit about your market in terms of the CNR and where you're seeing your strong sales as far as, you know, what are people buying and what are they not buying nowadays? Because everybody, it's kind of a double-edged sword right now, Brian. You know, I do retail, so I may be a little bit biased because I have a very strong self-defense clientele and not much of a hunting clientele, but I think there's a very sharp divide between people that are purchasing firearms because they know that they have to have them for personal protection, and there's people that are buying firearms because they think they won't be able to get them, versus the people that are selling, you know, grandpa's hunting shotgun. So I think there's a very strong contrast between what people are willing to spend and then also when they are spending, what they're buying.
Yeah, and you know, the hard part about the CNR items in the market is the, you know, let's face it, a CNR gun was probably made before 1950, at least the vast majority, because in 1950, the SKS and the AK-47 came to dominate the world scene. So you're seeing at least it's harder to find these items overseas now. You know, there's only so many Mausers that were made, and we've imported them for so long that they're starting to run out, and that's the sad part of the market. You know, we may never see British Enfields again. We may never see, you know, Venezuelan Mausers. That's just an item that, you know, that was probably all of them that were imported. So that's the sad part about it is, we may never see times like this again. And right now, where Mosin Nagants are $69.95, in the future, you know, that might be a $200 gun. So that's the part I hate, is that I may never see another shipment of Lugers again. And it was so fun, you know, to sell them when we had them, but those times may be over. Now, the ammo market's still really strong with that caliber, you know, 7.62 by 54R. We're still importing plenty of that ammo. 8mm, you know, it's starting to dry up. You still see some Mausers imported, still some K98s, but it's just not like it was 10 years ago where we had a lot more choices on the market.
Now, let me ask you something. Where are you seeing the surpluses and the shortfalls and the liabilities? I mean, obviously, you know, I've read, and I tell customers all the time, and you can look up on any website, you know, Mosin Nagant 9130. Russia made 17.4 million of them during the war. There is a time, potentially, that we will run low, but the time is not necessarily going to be, you know, apparent, whereas something like a Mauser or a 1903 Springfield, these stocks are dwindling rapidly in the demand, and the prices are obviously going up. So where does that leave us in terms of what are you seeing as trends? What are people getting right now?
Well, you still have a lot of the Ukraine is where a lot of this stuff is coming from right now. They have a lot of 9130 Mosin Nagants. They have a lot of Nagant revolvers. They have captured German K98s, but you don't see, you know, the variety there. And then out of other countries, you know, Turkey and Jordan still have large stockpiles of weapons that they will sell in the future. But some of the problems with coming out of these other countries is the storage. You know, the former Soviet bloc countries really stored their stuff really well. And they took care of it, and they refurbished it before it went into storage. So that's why we see these K98s and the 9130s coming in. They look great. They're head-spaced. They're ready to go. When you deal with South American countries, the Asian countries, anywhere in the Middle East, the stuff is not stored as well. And the care has not been, you know, they weren't taken care of as well. Let's face it, the humidity of South America, the sand of the Middle East is not really good on guns. So that's the bad news, is even some of the really interesting goods out there are just no longer in the condition that we can import, sell, and make money on.
That brings up a very interesting question, at least to my mind, Brian. And I just got to give a shout out to Iggy Ort, who's a life member of the NRA, the SAF, the U.S. SPA, and the IDPA. He actually requested me to get you on the air. But at any rate, the question that I guess comes to mind is, When you're talking about getting these, are you buying these? I mean, are you seeing these guns before they come into the country, or is it just kind of you're throwing your dice and hoping that they ship you a good batch of stuff? And if so, how do you distinguish between a quality import versus a lot of guns that you may not want to have anything to do with?
Well, one thing, that there is a popular misconception that AIM is an importer. We are not an importer. But I do have a lot of importers that work exclusively through AIM or prefer to go through AIM. So we have a lot of good relationships, and I get calls every day. You know, hey, Brian, there's a batch of, you know, P-64s in this country, or there's a batch of TT-33 pistols in this country. Are you interested? If the importer, you know, in either one of two things happens, the importer either does it on his own or we'll work with him, you know, specifying what we want, but all guns are inspected overseas. Nobody's going to trust these countries to what they're loading in the containers. So typically overseas what happens is when you inspect these firearms, you'll actually load them into the containers, seal the containers, and watch them get trucked on out of the location that they're in. So, but let's say that, you know, this is a batch that I have not had inspected overseas, or an importer that, you know, I'm not as close with. I travel all over the country to inspect goods here. You know, I was in Vermont 3 weeks ago. I inspected a bunch of guns. I was in Tennessee before that inspecting some guns. So, you know, we'll travel to wherever we need to go to make sure what we're buying is good quality merchandise, because we're kind of known to be a little pickier on what we sell. Unlike other distributors, when we buy a batch of, say, 1,000 guns, all 1,000 are not going to go out the door in very good condition. We will regrade what the importer has already looked through, and we'll say, listen, this doesn't meet, you know, our spec, so put that back on another shelf. And in the end, we'll sell off those guns at a cheaper price because they did not meet, you know, what we were going to sell for in the ad. A lot of importers don't do that. Other distributors. I've worked for other distributors, and not everybody does things the same way we do. But I think that the customers can trust us, and we have a reputation that, you know, hey, if AIM says it's in very good, it's in very good. And that's something we're proud of. And that's kind of how we got, you know, how we grew so fast, is because guys just knew they could trust us. If I say it's nice, it's nice. And
because of that,
we've had to travel.
That's really cool to hear, Brian. And this is, again, Brian from AIM Surplus. That's www.aimsurplus.com. An ARFCOM member and a great guest. And one of the things that makes me wonder about that is, and I'm sure many of the, you know, Radio Free ARFCOM audience is listening is saying the same thing, is how do you grade these guns? I mean, you've got a lot of, you know, say you have a lot of, you know, 1,000 AKs or whatever the case may be. Where does the grading process begin? And, you know, this is a very interesting topic, in particular for guys like me, because not only as the host of the show, but also as a gun store owner, you know, I have no idea where my, you know, surplus Mosin-Nagants or AKs are coming from. So tell me a little bit about your grading process and where these firearms actually come from, and then how you determine, is this a gun that's going to be good for aimsurplus.com?
Well, one thing, I have a long history in the industry. I'm only 35 years old, but I grew up, I was that little kid at the gun shows who worked with his dad. And my dad was a kind of a, you know, early guy in the industry into the surplus. But I grew up at a distributor, a gun distributor. So at 13, I was in there boxing guns. Back when the import side was actually a lot bigger than it is now, the shipments were bigger. What we do in our back warehouse, we actually have an overflow warehouse and then a shipping warehouse where we actually ship from. But let's say we get, you know, 1,000 Mosin-Nagant rifles in a shipment. We actually will open up a whole skid of them, lay out 200 guns right down a row of tables, and I'll have one of my guys go through there, and he picks up each gun, checks to make sure it has a front sight, make sure that the bolt works, make sure that the safety works, double check it, look for it for cracks, make sure there's nothing like a large wood repair that's really ugly, and he'll actually go through every gun. Then, you know, there's a lot of times where me or Eric that works for me or one of the other guys will actually go down the same line and double check these guns. You know, I want my guys to know what a very good condition firearm should look like, and I want them to know what a good condition firearm should look like. So we'll actually go through those guns, take a look at every one of them, and okay, these are graded. You know, these three come out, you know, put those on the bad shelf. And then, hey, open up the next skid, lay them all out. You know, we have to box them anyway. So while you're boxing, it's a great time to look at them. You know, take a look at what you're selling. You got to know, you know, are the bores good in these guns? Are the stocks in, you know, a refinished shape, or are they in original condition? Are the numbers matching on these pistols? And a lot of times I'll see something like, oh, hey, that German K98 is an SS Mark gun. I'm going to take that, and that's going to go to my office. So there are some perks to that. You know, you'll see some neat stuff from time to time, and, you know, I've got some really nice guns put aside that you, during the grading process, you saw and say, wow, that's really cool. I've never seen one of those. And, you know, you see some neat stuff that way.
Now, on the obviously, that covers the firearm level, but tell me a little bit about ammo. Okay, I mean, one of the things we're noticing in the retail market right now is that we're losing our butts because ammo prices have gone down. People like my boss bought a bunch of ammo hoping they could sell it, and now the prices have basically, at least for us in our market, basically crashed. They're coming down very quickly and very rapidly, and there's a lot of people saying, well, hey, you know, I can go to AIM Surplus or eBay or GunBroker and buy, you know, ammo with including shipping cheaper than I can get it from your retail store. Tell me about what you guys are seeing on the ammo front and how it affects the firearm community in general in terms of ammunition there, Brian.
Well, you know, the ammo game is actually what we're most known for right now. That's probably the biggest portion of our business is selling surplus ammunition. So to be competitive in that market, you have to buy a lot and you have to turn it fast. You know, guys all the time, I see on the boards, people say, hey, you know, such and such, you know, dealers are making way too much money on this ammo. The prices are too high. The dealers are gouging. Well, I can tell you from my perspective that on a good ammo deal, we'll make 17%. On a lot of our smaller calibers, like, you know, 22-250 or 270 or 30-30, you know, hey, we'll make 10%, you know, if it's an item that's going to continually move. So the market is not like a lot of consumers think it is, where we've gouged and made all this money. But for our business model, we buy large amounts of calibers. You know, there was one SKU in our system where I had 45 pallets come in last week, and I moved 45 pallets in that probably about 8 days. We didn't make great margins on it. You know, it was more of a 11% profit deal. But we turn it, move it, and turn it. 5.45, that's another item where, you know, hey, I want to move 2 million rounds a month. So I'm going to buy it cheap, and I'm going to sell it cheap and keep the product turning. And, you know, there is an ammo item that once in a while you'll make some good percentages on, and, you know, you got to really enjoy that. But there are so many items that we go out and we try to buy as much as we can so that we don't have any competition. You know, I prefer deals where if you want Romanian 8mm, for example, Aim Surplus is the only spot you're going to get that ammo from. And if somebody else has it, well, it's because I sold it to them. So I prefer to have, you know, those kind of items where I have the exclusive. So when we buy that, you know, I might have to buy, you know, 10 containers, 15 containers of that one item to have the exclusive. And the harder part is, you know, the hardest part about that is there's just not as much ammo in some of these calibers around anymore. You know, now it's like, you know, I celebrate because I found 2 million rounds of 308 at this importer, or I found 1 million rounds of some 7.62 by 39 surplus here. You know, 10 years ago, it was more like, hey, I found 10 million rounds of this item or 20 million rounds of this item. So the deals aren't as big as they used to be, but we're trying to buy as much as we can and as cheap as we can and then just turn the merchandise. You know, I don't want to have an item for 2 years. That's just not my business model. I want to take an item, sell it cheap, and move it. So
without giving away too many of your secrets, what, you know, where do you find a lot of this stuff? I mean, is it all communist bloc? I mean, is it NATO, Western Alliance stuff? I mean, you know, without giving away all your secrets, where are you finding this stuff? And how can you, you know, is it just a matter of moving volume? Because I know that in our gun store, it's hard to, you know, you have to move an awful lot to make a profit.
Yeah. They're in the surplus market. Let's face it, the 7.62 by 54R, 8mm, your 5.45 are generally going to come out of former Soviet bloc countries. The actual remaining 8mm I was talking about earlier actually came out of Romania, made on captured German machinery that made 8mm during World War II. So, you know, you get ammo out of everywhere, though. You know, the Hurtenberger 308 we had a few weeks ago, you know, I don't know where it came from. But it came in with a lot of other 308 to an importer here in the country. And generally on some of these larger deals, there's only a few guys in the country. They're going to bite off 10 containers or 5 containers of the same type of ammo. So we generally are one of the first guys who get called, in a situation like that. And we do have some really good relationships with importers. There's a lot of importers that I call my friends, and I, you know, I value their friendship. They take good care of us, and they're the, you know, when they get a big deal in, we're the first guy they call. They know we're going to pay our bills on time. They know, you know, we'll market their product and move it. So, you know, and I think that in the ammo game, let's face it, Federal, Remington, and Winchester, they run the pricing. If Federal, Remington, and Winchester decide that 223 is going to be sold for $250 wholesale on the market, which I wish it was that cheap right now, but if they decide that, well, surplus ammo has to come in below that. Nobody's going to buy 1980s Guatemalan 223 for 23 cents when you can go out and buy Federal for 25 cents. So those three guys dictate the market. And all the surplus stuff has to come in and find its place underneath those prices. So, you know, in 308, which has been a kind of a volatile product over the past couple of years, you know, when Winchester decides that 308 price is coming down, well, guess what? Our surplus 308 price has to come down to get in line. So those guys actually control the market, kind of like the stock exchange. Everybody else has to find, you know, put their prices in line after those guys.
All right, here's a quick one to put you on the spot. My boss goes on GunBroker and gets, you know, I don't know, 1,000 rounds of NATO Battle Pack 308. It's German surplus. It's in the green sleeves, you know, fully
yep.
sealed. And I think our cost on it, what he charged me, which is dealer cost, was like, I think it was $86 for 200 rounds. Good or bad?
Bad. I could have taken care of you much better than that.
Okay, well, see,
we're buying a lot more ammo to get those prices.
Right, but see, that, like I'm saying, that doesn't hurt my feelings, but that's something that I think that not only me, but ARFCOM listeners and members of Air15.com want to know, because, hey, I'm one of these guys that, and I tell my customers the same thing in the gun store or retail business that I run. I say, look, don't just purchase a firearm based on the price of the gun itself. Otherwise, you're never going to know what the true cost is. You need to figure, you need a half dozen magazines and at a minimum a 1,000 rounds or a case of ammunition if you're looking at any type of weapon that you're going to, firearm that you're going to be using for a potential combat/survival type of scenario. That's what you're looking at least a half dozen magazines plus the firearm plus the case of ammunition. I mean, and you obviously are in a place where we can provide that, but how do you make that sale? How do you convince that customer at the end of the day that that's the right move to do?
Well, the customer is going to buy what the customer wants to buy, but at the same time, the best salesman there ever is in a gun store is the actual guy behind the counter who has experience and knows what he shoots and knows what he wants to project. And that's why, most of your mainline manufacturers offer that pro shop deal to gun shop employees, because they know that, if you shoot a Kimber, you're going to sell Kimbers. If you shoot a Springfield, you're going to sell Springfields. But, if I had to give advice to a guy who's a new buyer right now, 5.45 is the caliber to have. Surplus 5.45 is half the price of 223 steel case. It's half the price of 7.62x39 steel case. It's a third of the price of 223 brass. So, my friends, I'm saying, hey, get into 5.45. You can buy an AK-74. Spikes Tactical came out with a brilliant new 5.45 upper for the AR. There's just so many neat things in that caliber. That's where I'm telling my friends to buy. And I think that, there's other neat items out there. Your typical 7.62x39 AK is a great blaster. And pricing's not bad on that. Ammo's $200 for 1,000 rounds. Well, for your average guy who goes out and shoots, that's at least 5 trips to the range. But if you're shooting 5.45, that's 10 trips to the range.
Now, so, one of the big complaints, just to play devil's advocate here for you, and I'm not trying to be, confrontational, but I have questions, and people come to me because, I've custom-built a number of AR-15 rifles, for myself and for friends and family and for gifts and whatnot. I've built firearms for people. I've built them in 5.56. I've built them in 6.8. I've customized AKs that I have or my buddies have. The problem that I've seen in 5.45 is that the perception is there that people think that is a limited round in terms of ammunition that's available. Many of my customers, when they purchase a firearm, they want to be able to purchase 1,000 rounds right off the start. Now, to you and me, 1,000 rounds, that's nothing. Okay? You know that. 1,000 rounds, mm-hmm. That's a drop in the bucket. But when you get the real guys that want to purchase magazines, they want to purchase 100 magazines, and they want to purchase 10,000 or 50,000 rounds of ammunition, they worry about the 5.5, the 5.45, as an ammunition that if they stopped importing it, could potentially dry up and they're going to be out of it. So where does that, how have you seen that dynamic in your day-to-day business with the 545 specifically?
Well, I think the worry on 5.45 is, let's face the facts. If you've been a comblock country for the past, 20 years, you've either used 5.45, made 5.45, or at least stockpiled 5.45. So it is the new surplus caliber. It is the caliber that in 30 years we will still be finding ammunition as long as there's no new import ban. And let's face it, if there's an import ban, it's going to hurt every caliber, not just 5.45. But that is the caliber that is going to be surplused. The good thing about it is that some of these countries are, switching to NATO and are buying 5.56, meaning their 5.45 is now obsolete and ready to be surplused. And there's just so much of it. When Russia makes ammunition, they don't mess around. They make a lot. And, the Ukraine is where most of this is coming from right now. And let's face the facts, they've got a lot. And we haven't even tapped into Russia yet because the Russians are a little bit higher on their ammunition. So long term, right now is the best time because pricing is so low on that 5.45. And I think most of our Air15.com listeners know that they've been warned by another importer and another retailer that, their pricing was going to go up September 1st. And I'm telling my customers the price is going to go up. And probably in September, I can't give them an exact date. When I run out of what I have, I'm going to pay more for the next shipment. At the same time, instead of it being 10 cents around, it's going to be 11 cents around. So it's still the cheapest game in town. And if I'm talking to one of my buddies, one of my friends, my advice to you, buy the ammo now. Go buy yourself 10 cans of ammo and worry about buying the gun later. That caliber is going to become more popular. Let's face it, Smith & Wesson is making a 5.45 AR-15. When Smith & Wesson joins the ballgame, there's a future in that caliber. So I think right now the key is for the listener, buy the ammo. You can always buy the gun later. But, while the ammo's cheap, stockpile it. I've got a rifle being built for myself right now, and it's, hey, I'm going to buy 10 cans of ammo, stick that in my basement, and that's going to be my future. And I'll buy some Silver Bear now and some surplus now to mess with. But it's more important to get the ammo while it's cheap. You can always pick up the gun later.
And, Brian, that is sage advice, sir. I do not mean to cut you off. We are running very low on time right now. I actually am going to have to let you run, brother. But thank you, sir, for being on Radio Free ARFCOM. You're welcome back anytime. And also, if you ever have any good tips for us and for our listeners on Radio Free ARFCOM as far as ammo or surplus firearms, we'd be certainly happy to hear from you, sir. Thank you again, Brian.
Hey, have a great night. You got a great show, man. I really appreciate it.
Well, we certainly appreciate having you. It wouldn't be the same without the guests. You make the show. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, man.
We are very rapidly running out of time here on Radio Free ARFCOM. I'm pushing my limits. My producers are putting me against the wall, which is their job, and I certainly thank them for that. We are not going to get to the zombie tip of the week, but we're going to do it as fast as we can before he cuts me off. Finally, we have a very special zombie tip of the week tonight. It's been said that there's only 7 degrees of separation between anyone and anything. This proved itself true this weekend with a buddy of mine. One of my buddies has a friend from England. His name is Luke. As we got to drinking and talking, he told me he's actually met Simon Pegg, better known as the Shaun of the Dead. I posted a pic of him and the two of them together in a pub in England. So while I may never get to meet Shaun of the Dead personally, I shook the hand of a man who's had drinks with him. And that's pretty freaking cool in my book. That being said, thanks to AR15.com for hosting the show. Most importantly, thanks to Radio Free ARFCOM fans. And be sure to accidentally the whole show to all your friends. And please visit AR15.com site sponsor links. Be sure to tune in next week for another great show. But until then, this has been your Radio Free ARFCOM.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.